Hey, gang, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and we are going to move. We are going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime exclusive interview from the On Deadline podcast. We're talking to author and journalist Madison Salters, author of Influencers Who Kill, a true crime collection, real stories of online fame and fatal consequences. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. Have you ever been scrolling on TikTok or Instagram and found yourself fascinated by an influencer? Maybe their life seems absurd or chaotic, or maybe it seems too perfect to be true. Well, it just might be. In her book, Salters details 9 horrifying true crime cases linked to the flashy and sometimes captivating world of influencers over the past 2 decades. These cases include Yuka Takaoka, a Japanese bar hostess who went to prison for a non-fatal stabbing. Nassim Agdam, the YouTube headquarters shooter. Snow the Salt Queen, a cosplay shooter who maintains their innocence. David Katz, a shooter who targeted a sports video game tournament. Samantha Walford, a mommy vlogger who was convicted of kidnapping and murder. Randy Stair, also known on YouTube as Andrew Blaze, who shot and killed his supermarket co-workers. Trey Sessler, known on YouTube as Mr. Anime, who pled guilty to murdering his family members. Pika Eric Ovinen, a YouTuber from the early aughts and perpetrator of one of Finland's few school shootings. And Abigail White, an OnlyFans model who was sentenced to life in prison for stabbing the father of her children to death. In my interview with Salters, we focused on the Yuka Takaoka, Snow the Salt Queen, and Samantha Walford cases. We also discussed the growing impact of social media on all of our lives. Here's my talk with Madison Salters, author of Influencers Who Kill.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, this concept is so great and interesting. And every time I've brought up that I'm doing this interview, people are like, oh my gosh, yes. What about Influencers Who Kill? But you're one of the first people that I've seen at least really compiling information about this. And I wanted to know what piqued your interest in this. Was it a specific case or just the concept overall?
What was really interesting, I should start by saying thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for your curiosity on this topic. I am a big true crime fan myself. I watch and read a lot of it. And Influencers Who Kill is my third book with Ulysses Press. And in fact, Ulysses reached out to me with about 21 names and this idea. They're saying that, you know, SEO, GEO is showing that people are really interested in this. Here are 21 names. Can you research them and sort of decide on a direction for an influencer's book? They had a lot of names they definitely wanted me to go with. And Yuka Takaoka was actually the only case I decided on for myself because I thought it tied into the other 8 cases I picked really well. And what piqued my interest in these specific 9 cases were 2 things. One, the element of parasociality. That's such a catchphrase these days, I feel like. But these parasocial relationships that we're creating as life moves more and more online, where social media, which was previously used even in the early aughts to really connect with our friends, our family members, now we're connecting with strangers more than ever. And we are kind of having one-sided relationships in a way with strangers, which is very typical for the human brain, but very atypical for being a big part of our day. So there was that element. And then there was also The shifting idea of what an influencer means. An influencer used to be a lot more of a grassroots niche kind of an expert that you really trusted because they were there week after week, sort of speaking to you almost on a personal level. And now it's almost like a job. So it feels like there was this 20-year period where influencers and murder were really on a much more personal level. You could see these parasocial relationships and this being forced into having a persona was really morphing people sometimes into their worst selves in a way that shifted these days. And I thought that was very interesting.
Absolutely. And I noted that time frame as well in the cases that you had. The earliest one, I think, goes back to 2007, which that's like around 20 years ago now. And I wanted you to explain a little bit more about that. You already touched on it a little bit, but in your research, how did you find that these cases reflected our growing, like, symbiotic attachment to influencers and online culture in those two decades?
Yeah. So I think what's interesting with the cases as they get closer to the modern day is you just sort of see them happening faster. And I will explain what that means. It's essentially when social media was still a little bit of the Wild West and people were still figuring out how to use it, I think it didn't bruise egos quite so much when, you know, somebody unfollowed you or you didn't get the amount of likes. It didn't have that same kind of tag on it where people are really counting how many people bookmarked this, how many people liked this, how many people commented on it, is it getting boosted? There wasn't that so much. So people who were doing this more towards 2007, it was really a slow roll for some of these people who ended up being the villains of their own story into this madness or this evil that they got plunged into. And it was the shift of social media itself was really responsible for a lot of this, feeling like they were getting lost. They didn't have an audience. They didn't have the look or the vibe or the persona to keep up with the shifts that were happening to something that was so integral in their life that it had taken over their life. But on the other side of that, on the other half of things, with the modern day and the people who are a little bit closer to 2026 when they were actually committing their crimes, we see it happen a lot more quickly. Like as soon as there's a dip in numbers or interest, we see them going, well, I need to do something more extreme, more to gain attention. And I need that attention immediately, especially for those influencers who are monetizing their streams. And if I could end cap that, I think one of the most interesting reasons for me that I included Yuka is she was somebody who is influential, but mostly became influential because of what she'd done. So now we see people monetizing murder or attempted murder effectively, which is sort of a crazy societal conversation point, I guess.
I also was struck by the cases that are in this book are all very different, but they also have some similarities. And you said it was very intentional the way that you picked them. So how do these cases go together? And what do they say about people who are, you know, maybe attracted to this attention of being an influencer and also violence?
Yeah, so I think what really ties these cases together is pop culture. Pretty much all of these would-be murderers or actual murderers were deeply involved in pop culture, in their influence sphere, and pop culture deeply influenced them as well. And I think anytime you're talking about violence, there is always a sort of panic around, is pop culture promoting violence? You have, you know, the satanic panic, you know, D&D is going to create killers, video games are going to create killers, violent movies create killers. Not necessarily the case, but when we do involve pop culture, instead what we're really looking at when we say pop culture is these are people who are involved in a niche because they often don't feel comfortable anywhere else. And that's really the thread I was finding between these cases was not that pop culture really encouraged them to do something, but that they were encouraged to try pop culture to find a place to fit in. And they also maybe found they didn't fit in there. So there's this theme running through of community, losing community, not having community. And this is often paired with deep personality defects, if I can put it that way. It's a little unkind, but you know, some of these people suffered from grandiose personality disorder, very severe narcissistic personality disorder, lack of empathy. So when you tie this into attempting to find a community, not finding that community, and then deciding to create a persona to control those communities, to feel like you have some control in your life, only for those communities to maybe turn on you or not be interested in you or not engage with you, this creates a lot of rage. And I saw a lot of that throughout.
Really fascinating. And then I wanted to get into some of the specific cases, not all of them, of course, that would be a very long interview. You mentioned already the Yuka case. So I wanted you to maybe detail a little bit about that one. I think that was the entry case to this. What exactly happened there? What year was it? And what do people need to know about it?
Yeah, so the Yuka case was very interesting because of the conclusion more than what happened and what has happened since. And I think it ties very interestingly into the Snow case as well, which is in most of the cases in the book, you're going to see a criminal who perpetuated a crime, who either went to prison or perished due to their crimes. In the cases of Yuka and Snow, and I'm sorry to bring in another case, but they do really tie together. We have two people who committed a crime, but essentially get to walk away and live a normal life, even though everyone is aware of the crime.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Snow is short for Snow the Salt Queen, the online moniker of Mary Ann Oliver Snow, a TikToker who was accused of manslaughter. Salters will discuss her research into that case a little later on. First, we'll talk about the Yuka Takaoka case. Back in 2018, then 21-year-old Yuka Takaoka met a man named Phoenix Luna. She tried to kill him in his sleep, leading to a now infamous photo of Yuka covered in blood while sitting in the lobby of a Tokyo apartment building.
She essentially was a host bar worker in Tokyo, which is a form of red light district work in Japan. And she fell in love with a host, and a male host is essentially paid to pretend to be your boyfriend. So they were in the same trade. But she sort of fell for it and started paying him a lot of money. And he came over to help her move her things just to be a good friend outside of work. She went through his phone, saw some photos of him with other women, which is his job. And she knew that, and stabbed him in his sleep with the intent of murdering him and then committing suicide. And he escaped the apartment. He got down to the lobby by some miracle with her chasing him. And she just sat in a pool of his blood waiting for him to die and waiting for the police to get there. And the shocking conclusion of this is after being in a 5-day coma and not dying, Luna, who was the victim, he said he felt for her. He understood what she was going through, that people who work in this sort of red light district trade often have difficult backgrounds. And he didn't really want her to suffer or go to jail. He just sort of wanted her to pay his medical bills. She was instructed to pay the medical bills and only went to jail for about 3.5 years. The judge granted clemency, even though she didn't regret what she did. She had totally intended to murder him. And the internet took her side. They were like, What an amazing woman. She loved him so much. She was willing to die. I wish I had a girlfriend like this. Look at this beautiful killer. And they really, you know, had a backlash against Luna that kind of drove him a little bit crazy, where they were like, you prey on women, your job is to be a liar, you deserve this. So it was this incredible case of this brutality that was completely undeserved, where the victim got blamed even after forgiving his own attacker. And now the influencer, Yuka, makes money off of this. She has a huge following. People line up to get her autograph. And so you can sometimes commit a crime and then get a following for it.
That is just unbelievable. I did not know about this case until I started looking into your book. I can't believe more people don't know about that. Then you connected it to another one of the cases in your book, which, since that was the case that your publishers brought to you, this other case I'm guessing you found in your research. How did you come across it? How does it connect to this case?
So I think that's the Snow case. And the Snow case is very interesting because I think it's one of the two cases that people really feel they know. Snow and Nassim are probably the two most famous cases in the book, Nassim being the YouTube headquarters shooter, and Snow because Rolling Stone did a piece on their victim, Helen Hastings. And it was a piece that sort of set the internet ablaze because Snow had been a very popular influencer who suddenly disappeared. And when Helen Hastings was killed, she just sort of disappeared from school, and they said something had happened, and all of her college friends were like, well, we don't really know what happened. And internet sleuths started putting two and two together and reaching out to news stations like, what's happened here? Because a girl died and then another girl took a break, but then came back. Snow came back to the internet 2 months after Helen Hastings was killed by Snow, and started posting murder content. Content like, do you want to hide a body, to the tune of like Disney songs, with blood, head to toe in blood, with knives, just really kind of wild stuff. And it came to light, especially when this Rolling Stone story broke about Helen, that Snow had shot Helen at point blank range with 9 witnesses, while drunk and high, with underage minors who were drunk and high in their home, which they owned. And it was an accident. They did not know the gun was loaded. You know, libel laws are pretty strong, so you have to be very careful about what you say. Some of the feedback I've gotten on the book is maybe I was the most biased or kindest towards Snow, which is not necessarily how I felt while writing it. But you have to understand that despite doing this, Snow got something called a deferred adjudication, which means no trial took place for Snow. And Snow officially, I believe in 2 years, if they do not commit any other crimes, will be literally held innocent of this crime that had multiple witnesses, despite the fact that some of the witness statements maybe don't add up, despite the fact that I did have interviews with people who knew Snow, who were saying that they were a violence risk from the start, that they had told people to kill themselves. Despite quite a lot of disturbing information on Earth, this person will be totally innocent of any crime. So that's why I have to say, you know, killing and not something like murder, because it legally speaking isn't murder. So whether or not it was an accident, a jury never got a say. None of the witnesses would come forward and talk about it. I had to listen to police recordings. Everything has sort of been very hush-hush ever since then. Helen's parents didn't want to talk about it. So it was just another sort of example of a case where the person went right back to influencing because that was their bread and butter. And now has a huge following of people who are like, yes, murder me, queen. You're so sexy. I love you. I'm so glad you're back. And that's why I bring in parasocial relationships, because we often talk about influencers, but not the other side of that relationship. How do influencers get to be that way. It's only because we are chatting with them. We are paying them. We are relating to them. So something that these two people are putting out there is really connecting with people, despite one having killed somebody and the other having very much meant to kill somebody.
Another case Salters covers in her book is the Samantha Walford case. Walford was a mommy vlogger who was sentenced to 99 years in prison in 2017 for the kidnapping and killing of her husband, Ernest Lee Ibarra.
One that I was interested in a little bit from the list was the Samantha Walford case, because I think it touches on a lot of interesting stuff. Of course, she's the influencer. Her husband was a gamer, which is also kind of, you know, adjacent to the influencer lifestyle. What do you think that case kind of reveals about these themes that we've been talking about, the intersection between attention and violence?
That case was by far the hardest for me to write personally, because while she did hire three men to kill her husband, essentially, it was very clear that this person, to some degree or another, was abusive towards her five children as well, which was tough because her whole thing was being a mommy blogger. What this really revealed to me was the toxicity of trying to have a persona that doesn't necessarily fit who you are. One of the things I always say, having a background in investigative journalism, and especially when you're intaking stories from multiple different angles, you're going to find that the facts, quote unquote, don't match up. People will swear they remember something one way and the facts won't match. So I always say, believe what you see, not what you hear. And Samantha was really devastating. Her entire influential sphere was about how much she loved her children. And yet she was smoking during her pregnancies. There were snippets of her saying, you know, you think that my children's birth would be the happiest time in my life. But no, it was kind of a bummer. It was kind of a letdown. The happiest moment of my life was when I cheated on their father with this guy I invited to sleep in my house with my children before even knowing who he was. He was a hitchhiker. She was endangering her children. She was doing, mommy blogs where in the middle of it, she would have her children go away even though they were throwing up or using a plugged-in device that they shouldn't have been using. Just really horrific stuff. And she was also interested in true crime, but particularly what she was interested in was violence against children. She did a lot of segments on the horrors of violence against children, but then really harped on what had happened to those kids and was clearly reading up on this sort of stuff in a way that maybe wasn't healthy. She didn't like that her husband was a gamer. She was, in my opinion, a narcissist who had a very bad problem with pathological lying. She said she entered the Maxine Gamer competition, but then was calling women who did gaming all sorts of horrible names. She said she only entered because her brother was dying. Her brother seems to be just fine from everything I found. Her husband had an online romance between his character and another character. They got married and she was so mad about it that that's why he married her in real life, was to stop that. That jealousy. But ultimately, this idea that she had to be a mommy blogger became her sort of reason for existing. But this is somebody who's so unqualified to be a mommy blogger. She was not even qualified to be a mother in some respect. She has a video on the Wayback Machine, which I had to use quite a bit, where literally she was smoking and saying she had no vices while being pregnant and saying her doctor had told her that cutting back to only like one or two a day was so noble of her. No doctor on earth would tell you just cut back to two a day while pregnant. It was very clearly a lie, not even very thinly veiled.
That makes me wonder, you know, we're both journalists, so I do, and I'm sure you do, kind of greet a lot of things I see online with some skepticism. you know, if you see a mommy vlogger, I don't always think that they have a perfect life. You know, I know there's different things going on behind the scenes often, but has researching this book made you even more skeptical when you are, you know, going through TikTok or Instagram and you see influencers? How has it changed your own relationship with social media?
That is such a great question. I think it has made me even more wary of using social media, I will say. The way that people can take whatever you post and run with it, it's sort of one of the things I learned is there's almost no good video. If you have a video up online, it could be of you saving a kitten and somebody will be like, you handled that kitten wrong. Could be of you buying cupcakes for a birthday party and somebody will go, but did you check that they had peanuts? I bet you didn't because you're evil. Like somebody will be upset about something after hours and hours and hours of going through social media. I was like, whew, okay. So maybe don't read the comment section is what I learned. But I also learned to think about social media less in how I'm intaking it. Like I'll see something beautiful by an influencer, like, wow, I love that outfit. And to think about it more intentionally, what was their intention in posting it? What are they trying to say? Not just what is the impression I am taking from it? Because that tells me a lot more about why the post is up. Like if my mother posts a photo for my birthday of me when I was a baby, I know that she's reminiscing. Like there's nothing really deeper going on there. But you know, if somebody's like, I got this really cool new watch, check it out. You know, they probably want people to be impressed. Like you are posting it to impress people. And I think that can help, at least for me reply with what people's needs actually are. Like, it's not going to be helpful to be like, who uses a watch anymore? Use a phone. Like, no, just say like, that's really cool. Thanks for sharing that with me. So I think I come at it from a much more intentional point of view of thinking, what are you trying to accomplish with this post? And if it's my friend, how can I help you accomplish it? And if it's a stranger, I don't interact with it much anymore. I'm just like, you know what? You never know. I need to detox a little bit after this book.
That's probably a good way to go about it. I support that. And then something else I wanted to touch on. So the three cases that we talked about were all women, which, you know, I write a lot about true crime and I've researched a lot about it. And the fact is often men are the perpetrators. Women are a little smaller percentage, but it seems a little bit different, at least in this sample size of influencers who kill. Now, do you think that that is, you know, just representative of there being more women in the influencer industry, or do you think there's something else going on?
I'm so happy you brought this up. In my second book, Scams and Cons, it was also a little bit more female leaning than what the demographics would show. I believe the most recent demographics, I might be off, these might be 2025, is that 77% of all violent crime is perpetrated by men, whereas 18% by women and 5%, the data is unknown. So really in my second book, I went into a lot of research on why are we sort of focusing more on female con artists than male con artists if there are so many more. And I kind of came to the same conclusion with the Influencers Who Kill book, which is it's not indicative. No, men are still the perpetrators of more violent crime, even in the influential spheres and online spheres and parasocial spheres. But people, readers, are usually more interested in something a little bit rarer. Because women are more rarely the perpetrators of violent crimes, their stories are more interesting, more intriguing. They raise a lot more red flags, like, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Tell me more. So again, the list I was given was pretty female or even non-binary heavy. I believe that Nassim, Samantha, Abigail, those were women, and then Snow and Randy are sort of in the non-binary area, and Yuka, of course, is a woman as well, and then the rest are men. So men are a little bit underrepresented in this book. But again, I think it's because there's more of a shock value around women. Like, unfortunately, that is just sort of what it is. If you say that, you know, a strange man killed a child, like, that's terrible and shocking. But if you hear, like, a mother killed a child, everybody's like, how does that happen? So I think there's some bias in publishing. I think there's some bias in myself, probably. There's some bias in reading, where people are just a little more fascinated by the rarity of female murderers.
Yes, I agree. That's something that I see as well. Just, you know, the how many people are going to click on a story. It does happen to be something a little bit more, you know, off the beaten path like that. So I think you're right. I just wanted to end asking you if there's anything else you think that our listeners need to know about this topic. Are you planning on, it's kind of an evolving thing. So do you plan on, you know, doing an update to this book, or maybe a second one about the same topic, or are you moving on to different true crime topics?
Thank you for asking. So yeah, I picked these cases specifically because I learned from my second book, don't do evolving cases. So for the most part, so that I won't have to edit or update, these cases are pretty much done. And I wanted to be able to have all of the evidence. I think the main thing I would say is, when you're reading, try to read it in your own voice. Because I'm not allowed to come to conclusions for you. I am only allowed to present you the information. And that's some of the fun, if we can call it that, of true crime, is you kind of pick up the breadcrumbs and you decide who was at fault and what could have made a difference, and could anything have made a difference. So examine it yourself, read deeply, decide who you think is at fault or what you think is at fault. And yeah, no, I don't have any plans to do an update, but I did just get my fourth book commission, and it'll be my first fiction book, but it is also about murder. So stay tuned for fictional murder in the future.
I'm excited about that. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about it and your maybe inspiration for it. That's very exciting.
Thank you. That would be great.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks, of course, to our guest, Madison Salters, author of Influencers Who Kill, a true crime collection, real stories of online fame and fatal consequences. You can find her book on Amazon and many places online. You can find these true crime roundups and exclusive interviews by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, real people tell their stories live on stage.
I burst into tears. And I wasn't sure if I was crying because I hadn't been kissed in a really long time, or if I had just never been kissed like that before.
To hear fascinating, heartbreaking, and sometimes hilarious stories from astronauts, teachers, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.